You're in tune to KZSU Stanford. It's time for another edition of Raising Sand.
Baruch Ata Adonai. Baruch Abba Yerushalayim. Baruch Ata Adonai. Baruch Abba Yerushalayim.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore. Today, bringing you the voices of Kathy Kelly and Josh Bollier, coordinators of Camp Hope in Chicago, as well as Vets for Peace Executive Director Michael McPherson and Dan Pearson from the encampment itself. But first, let's look at Gaza. We're going into the third week of violence in the Gaza Strip, and the Israeli Air Force recently dropped leaflets meant, and I quote, as a general warning that Israel was about to escalate an operation and begin a new phase in the war on terror. The warning came as Israeli troops pressed on with the deadly offensive in defiance of a UN Security Council resolution calling for a ceasefire. Navi Pillay, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights and the United Nations' most senior human rights official, said that the Israeli military may have committed war crimes in Gaza. He has called for credible, independent, and transparent investigations into possible violations of humanitarian law and singled out an incident this week in Zeytun, southeast of Gaza City, where up to 30 Palestinians in one house were killed by an Israeli shelling. So far, 13 Israelis have been killed in this conflict, three of whom were civilians. In Gaza, more than 800 Palestinians, including 265 children, have been killed and more than 3,000 injured. More than 20,000 Gazans have fled their homes in the north of the Strip and thousands more in the south. Some are even dividing their families between different addresses for fear of losing them all in a single airstrike. We can expect many more deaths and injuries, given the geographic reality of the Gaza Strip. It is bordered on the south by Egypt, on the west by the Mediterranean Sea, and on the north and east by Israel. The total area of the Gaza Strip is 146 square miles, or 378 square kilometers, with one of the highest population densities in the world. In 2008, the population was 1,537,269, giving it a population density of 11,060 per square mile, or 4,270 persons per square kilometer. Despite the intense bombardment, at least 30 rockets were fired from Gaza into southern Israel last Thursday. Now, Rashid Khalili is the Edward Said Professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University and the Director of the Middle East Initiative at Columbia School of International and Public Affairs. Rashid Khalili's books are among the most frequently assigned works on the Middle East in American colleges. His latest book is Sowing Crisis, the Cold War and the American Dominance in the Middle East. This following op-ed by Rashid Khalili appeared in the New York Times on January the 7th. It's entitled, What You Don't Know About Gaza. Nearly everything you've been led to believe about Gaza is wrong. Below are a few essential points that seem to be missing from the conversation, much of which has taken place in the press about Israel's attacks on the Gaza Strip. The Gazans. Most of the people living in Gaza are not there by choice. The majority of the 1.5 million people crammed into the roughly 140 square miles of the Gaza Strip belong to families that came from towns and villages outside Gaza, like Ashkelon and Beersheba. They were driven to Gaza by the Israeli army in 1948. The occupation. The Gazans have lived under Israeli occupation since the Six-Day War in 1967. Israel is still widely considered to be an occupying power, even though it removed its troops and settlers from the Strip in 2005. Israel still controls access to the area. imports and exports, and movements of people in and out. Israel has control over Gaza's airspace and seacoast, and its forces enter the area at will. As the occupying power, Israel has the responsibility under the Fourth Geneva Convention to see to the welfare of the civilian population of the Gaza Strip. The blockade. Israel's blockade of the Strip, with the support of the United States and the European Union, has grown increasingly stringent since Hamas won the Palestinian Legislative Council elections in January 2006. Fuel, electricity, imports, exports, and the movement of people in and out of the Strip have been slowly choked off, leading to life-threatening problems of sanitation, health, water supply, and transportation. The blockade has subjected many to unemployment, penury, and malnutrition. This amounts to a collective punishment, with the tacit support of the United States, of a civilian population for exercising its democratic rights. The ceasefire. Lifting the blockade, along with the cessation of rocket fire, was one of the key terms of the June ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. This accord led to the reduction in rockets being fired from Gaza from hundreds in May and June to a total of less than 20 in the subsequent 4 months, according to Israeli government figures. The ceasefire broke down when Israeli forces launched major air and ground attacks in early November. 6 Hamas operatives were reportedly killed. War crimes. The targeting of civilians, whether by Hamas or by Israel, is potentially a war crime. Every human life is precious, but the numbers speak for themselves. Nearly 700 Palestinians, most of them civilians, have been killed since the conflict broke out at the end of last year. In contrast, there have been around a dozen Israelis killed, many of them soldiers. Negotiation is a much more effective way to deal with rockets and other forms of violence. This might have been able to happen had Israel fulfilled the terms of the June ceasefire and lifted its blockade of the Gaza Strip. This war on the people of Gaza isn't really about rockets, nor is it about restoring Israel's deterrence, as the Israeli press might have you believe. Far more revealing of the words of Moshe Yalon, then the Israeli Defense Force Chief of Staff in 2002. Yalon said, "The Palestinians must be made to understand in the deepest recesses of their consciousness that they are a defeated people." That's Rashid Khalili's op-ed in the New York Times on January 7th. I'm also going to share an article, also in the New York Times, this one January 8th, by Tagid El-Kurderi from Gaza City. "The emergency room in Shifa Hospital is often a place of gore and despair. On Thursday was also a lesson in the way ordinary people are squeezed between suicidal fighters and a military behemoth." Dr. Auni Aljaru, 37, a surgeon at the hospital, rushed in from his home here, dressed in his scrubs, but he came not to work. His head was bleeding and his daughter's jaw was broken. He said Hamas militants next to his apartment building had fired mortar and rocket rounds. Israel fired back with force and his apartment was hit. His wife, Albina, originally from the Ukraine, and his one-year-old son were killed. "My son has been turned into pieces," he cried. "My wife was cut in half. I had to leave her body at home." Because Albina was a foreigner, she could have left Gaza with her children last week, but Dr. Jaru lamented that she would not leave him behind. A car arrived with more patients. One was a 21-year-old man with shrapnel in his left leg who demanded quick treatment. He turned out to be a militant with Islamic Jihad. He was smiling a big smile. "Hurry," he said, "I must get back so I can keep fighting." He was told that there were more serious cases than his, that he needed to wait. But he insisted. "We are fighting the Israelis," he said. "When we fire, we run, but they hit back so fast. We run into houses to get away," he continued, smiling. "Why are you so happy?" this reporter asked. Look around you." A girl who looked about 18 screamed as a surgeon removed shrapnel from her leg. An elderly man was soaked in blood. A baby, a few weeks old and slightly wounded, looked around helplessly. A man lay with parts of his brain coming out. His family wailed at his side. "Don't you see that these people are hurting?" the militant was asked. "But I am from the people too," he said, his smile incandescent. "They lost their loved ones as martyrs. They should be happy. I want to be a martyr too." Meanwhile, the United States Senate is preparing to vote on the following resolution on the war in Gaza. The first session of the 111th Congress. Senate resolution recognizing the right of Israel to defend itself against attacks from Gaza and reaffirming United States' strong support for Israel in its battle with Hamas and supporting the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. In the Senate of the United States, Mr. Reid, for himself, and Mr. McConnell submitted the following resolution, which was referred to the committee. The resolution recognizing the right of Israel to defend itself against attack from Gaza and reaffirming the United States' strong support for Israel in its battle with Hamas and supporting the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. Whereas Hamas was founded with the stated goal of destroying the State of Israel. Whereas Hamas has been designated by the Secretary of State as a foreign terrorist organization. Whereas Hamas has refused to comply with the requirements of the Quartet, that is the United States, the European Union, Russia, and the United Nations, that Hamas recognize Israel's right to exist, renounce violence, and agree to accept previous agreements between Israel and the Palestinians. Whereas in June 2006, Hamas crossed into Israel, attacked Israeli forces, and kidnapped Corporal Gilad Shalit, whom they continue to hold today. Whereas Hamas has launched thousands of rockets and mortars since Israel dismantled settlements and withdrew from Gaza in 2005. Whereas Hamas has increased the range of its rockets, reportedly with support from Iran and others, putting additional large numbers of Israelis in danger of rocket attacks from Gaza. Whereas Hamas locates elements of its terrorist infrastructure in civilian population centers, thus using innocent civilians as human shields. Whereas Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said in a statement on December 27, 2008, that we strongly condemn the repeated rockets and mortar attacks against Israel and hold Hamas responsible for breaking the ceasefire and for the renewal of violence there. Whereas on December 27, 2008, Prime Minister of Israel Ehud Olmert said, for approximately 7 years, hundreds of thousands of Israeli citizens in the south have been suffering from missiles being fired at them. In such a situation, we had no alternative but to respond. We do not rejoice in battle, but neither will we be deterred from it. The operation in the Gaza Strip is designed, first and foremost, to bring about an improvement in the security reality for the residents of the south of the country. Whereas on January 2, 2009, Secretary of State Rice stated that Hamas has held the people of Gaza hostage ever since their illegal coup against the forces of President Mahmoud Abbas, the legitimate president of the Palestinian people. Hamas has used Gaza as a launching pad for rockets against Israeli cities and has contributed deeply to the very bad daily life for the Palestinian people in Gaza and to the humanitarian situation that we have all been trying to address. Whereas the humanitarian situation in Gaza, including shortages of food, water, electricity, and adequate medical care, is becoming more acute. Whereas Israel has facilitated humanitarian aid to Gaza with over 500 trucks and numerous ambulances entering the Gaza Strip since December 26, 2008. Whereas on January 2, 2009, Secretary of State Rice stated that it was Hamas that rejected the Egyptian and Arab calls for an extension of the Tahidiya that Egypt had negotiated, and that the United States was working towards a ceasefire that would not allow a reestablishment of the status quo ante where Hamas can contribute to launch rockets out of Gaza. It is obvious that the ceasefire should take place as soon as possible, but we need a ceasefire that is durable. End quote. And whereas the ultimate goal of the United States is a sustainable resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that will allow for a more viable and independent Palestinian state living side by side in peace and security with the State of Israel, which will not be possible as long as Israeli civilians are under threat from within Gaza. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Senate express vigorous support and unwavering commitment to the welfare, security, and survival of the State of Israel as a Jewish and democratic state with the secure borders and recognizes its right to act in self-defense to protect its citizens against act of terrorism. 2. Reiterates that Hamas must end the rocket and mortar attacks against Israel, recognizes Israel's right to exist, renounce violence, and agree to accept previous agreements between Israel and Palestinians. Number 3 encourages the president to work actively to support a durable, enforceable, and sustainable ceasefire in Gaza as soon as possible that prevents Hamas from retaining or rebuilding the capability to launch rockets and mortars against Israel and allows for the long-term improvement of daily life conditions for the ordinary people of Gaza. Number 4 strongly believes that the lives of innocent civilians must be protected and all appropriate measures should be taken to diminish civilian casualties, that all involved should continue to work to address humanitarian needs in Gaza. Number 5 supports and encourages efforts to diminish the appeal and influence of extremists in Palestinian territories and to strengthen moderate Palestinians who are committed to a secure and lasting peace with Israel, and reiterates its strong support for United States government efforts to promote a just resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict through a serious and sustained peace process that leads to the creation of a viable and independent Palestinian state living in peace alongside the secure state of Israel. That is a resolution coming before the United States Senate by Mr. Reid and Mr. McConnell. What can I say? There is a link to this resolution on the Raising Sand Radio website, www.raisingsandradio.org, if you want to see it before contacting your congressional representative. To learn more about the situation as it unfolds, go to Gaza Siege, http://gazasiege.org. And the website of the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee at www.adc.org, or call the ADC at 202-244-2990. Now let's turn to Kathy Kelly and Josh Bollier, co-coordinators of Camp Hope in Chicago, and Veterans for Peace Executive Director Mike Pearson and Dan Pearson from the actual encampment itself. Today it's my great pleasure to introduce Kathy Kelly. I don't know that I really need to introduce Kathy Kelly, the co-founder of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, and Josh Brulier. Welcome. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
How are you today? Is it freezing out there?
Well, Susan, I have to confess I'm playing hooky from Camp Hope this morning. I had to tidy up some loose ends, having made a decision to head over to Egypt and to the Rafah border crossing as close as possible anyway. So I'm here with one of my companions who is also heading down to Camp Hope in the very near future, Josh Brulier. Yeah. Josh was one of the people who worked steadily to build up community forums and to help create the kind of a little infrastructure for Camp Hope. And he's also a musician, so it's been great to be encouraged by his singing, which was very much on the first day. An encouraging step. We were joined by really about 175 people to launch Camp Hope, and including our MC, the Reverend Dr. Finley Campbell, who traces his history back to the Civil Rights Days, walking alongside the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. And this is a 19-day encampment. During our first days, we were very aware that President-elect Barack Obama was literally just down the street. And he drove past in his motorcade. He didn't choose to come out, but we think that we all bear a big responsibility to break through the silence, for instance, on the horrific attacks against Gaza, mm-hmm. and keep raising our voices.
Well, it's great to have you because you are, again, helping the nation understand what we need to do to get our president-elect to fulfill some of the promises, one of them being, I will always be honest with you, and I will always listen to you even when we disagree. What are we doing at Camp Hope?
Well, Susan, the idea was originated by friends in St. Louis who thought, okay, it's looking as though we might actually have a president in office who would, as you say, listen and who might be reflective and thoughtful. And I think that, you know, there's been great despair over the recklessness and the ruthlessness of previous presidential figures and the people surrounding them. And so that was kind of the inception of Camp Hope, that we would confine ourselves to asking for things that he could do within the first 100 days of office without even consulting Congress. You know, executive orders could be issued, for instance, to close Guantanamo or have a 90-day moratorium on housing foreclosures, and also things that he himself had envisioned along the campaign trail. But of course, I think your listeners would understand that as history unfolds, you know, we're all in history up to our necks, as Camus said, and, you know, the attacks on Gaza have begun with such ferocity that, of course, we are also saying that every effort must be taken nonviolently to stop these horrendous attacks. And certainly we're greatly perturbed by the attacks on civilians in Afghanistan and Pakistan by, you know, drone Reaper MQ-9 unmanned aerial vehicles. So these things are also very much part of the mix. But our main mandate or the task we assign ourselves is to creatively reach out to people in the president-elect's neighborhood and beyond. And, you know, it's pretty cold out there. And to be there from shortly after sunup until sundown, you know, your cheeks are windburned and you're shivering. But we certainly know that that's just a very, very small part of what people are experiencing who've been made homeless by housing foreclosures and by an economy that's been merciless toward the neediest people in our society, much less to think about people on the mountainsides in Afghanistan and Pakistan or people in Gaza right now. The reports are just horrific of carnage and bereavement and no doubt a great desire for retaliation.
And a fairly unapologetic stance from the United States and Israel, France, England.
Collaboration and being an accomplice to murder come to mind.
Has Obama become aware of Camp Hope at this point?
What do you think, Josh?
Well, I mean, from what I've heard, the motorcade has come by several times at the campsite, and we've also we did everything we could to reach out. We contacted through the web, through letters, and also went to the transition team office. So I'm sure that they should be aware, but we have yet to see President-elect at the actual site. But we'll see.
Well, I think he might have flown overhead last night to go back to Washington, D.C., but when the motorcade went by, I mean, I could see him in the seat. The window was rolled down. He made eye contact.
He must be going, what have I got myself into?
Yeah, and he might have wondered, you know, who are these people? But these are the people who were shoulder to shoulder with him as a community organizer, at least in spirit. And so, you know, we think that he is very, very aware of the people, for instance, who, as his neighbors, when he was in the University of Chicago area and went to, for instance, a send-off gathering for Rashid Khalidi when he went to kind of take the place of Edward Said at Columbia University, you know, he knows these issues, and I can't imagine that he wouldn't be feeling pained and aggrieved over not speaking out. I don't know who is advising him to remain silent and numb in the face of the attacks against Gaza, but that's certainly something we must ourselves break. We have to break with silence and break with complicity.
How can our listeners participate in Camp Hope? Is there a website that they can perhaps donate to? Or
Josh, how about talking about that?
Yeah. The website is www.camphope2009.org, and there is a link to donate online. So you can get there through CampHope2009.org, and then also it has directions to the vigil site, which is at Drexel and Hyde Park Boulevard on the south side of Chicago, and basically everything about the times for the events and what time we'll be out there.
We have community forums almost every night from here on until the ending. We deliberately are ending it on the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday. And on that date, our friends with the Christian Peacemaker team, who have themselves been at the other end of guns shooting in Colombia and Hebron and Palestine and Iraq, they're creating a facsimile of a drone unmanned aerial vehicle. And we'd like to see such things tethered to the ground, grounded permanently. And so they'll carry that over to the Boeing headquarters, and that's part of the way that we'll close out Camp Hope. So, you know, here in Chicago, we have Boeing headquarters here, but I know that your listeners in California have headquarters for other corporations, you know, that have everything to do with making attacks against people in other lands. And, you know, as we think about what attacks people here at home, insurance companies attack people's budgets horribly. And in fact, over half of the bankruptcies declared in the United States have been related to people who had outstanding medical bills that they couldn't meet. So, you know, we want to link these issues together. We want the union people to be together with the people concerned about immigration. We want the immigration people to be together with the people that are seeking housing and full employment. And certainly we want all of us to be together in saying abandon every single military project anywhere in the world.
It's very hard to bring together all of the different groups, but I think you're right. It's essential that we begin to really do this in this country and really create an integrated picture of how these things all fit together. They're not isolated incidents. They're not isolated businesses. We're all in this together, aren't we?
But, you know, as a microcosm, I've certainly already seen in our 5 days down at Camp Hope since we launched it that I've certainly seen people coming together. I mean, I have to confess, even though I've lived in Chicago all my life, I haven't been down to the south side of Chicago very often since having left studies down there. So I think it's very, very important for us to build the personal relationship so that the person you're calling at the other end of the phone isn't, an anonymous person, but rather, you know, you've gotten to know each other and you can call on each other in times when it's important to be escalating our level of risk and our level of amplified voices together. Josh had a chance to connect with some people on the issue of economic justice, and I'm a little jealous now of his contacts.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's part of building Camp Hope. It's been nice to see the solidarity between groups. We've been working with Southsiders together, organizing for power. We've been working to keep affordable housing and stop foreclosures on the South Side and stop gentrification. To see people coming together for this project, I mean, I think it says, you know, that on a number of issues, like the public has consistently weighed in on these issues, and this is the change that we do want to see. These are the things that the American public is concerned about. And even though it is a variety of issues, we can all stand together and collectively put our voice out there and let Obama know, let the people who have their hands on the political machinery know that this is what we're looking for. And, when you have to go up against the special interests, when you have to go up against the corporations, when you have to go up against all those people, that we're behind you and we do support you because this is what we want to see. So, I mean, I think it's been great to see that from a number of groups, not only for housing and foreclosures, but the immigration rights groups and also the economic justice movement and ecological justice.
When this show is archived, I'm going to put a link up there with a poll that was recently done in the United States. And it's actually fascinating because all of the issues that the progressive people are talking about, the American people generally are talking about, how we are using way too many resources in the world, how we really are working too hard and want to spend more time with our families. I think there are like 15 points that were actually quite astonishing to me because we have a sense that, there's not everybody's singing from the same song here. And as I say, I'll put that up so that our listeners can go and refer to it because I think there's such awareness that we really do have to change things.
And there's certainly no copyright on Camp Hope. We'd be delighted if people in other parts of the country wanted to set up their version of Camp Hope. We now have a group in Maine and a group in Pennsylvania, I believe, and also in the Modesto area of California, planning to have at least a day or two of vigiling. And, there are PDF documents that people are welcome to download from our website and go ahead and form a Camp Hope. And I think people would know that Voices for Creative Nonviolence has always felt that ourselves, we as activists can escalate the level of nonviolent risk that we take. And, we also know that any serious effort to confront militarism in our time has to involve an individual and collective effort to change our approaches toward consumption of fossil fuels and other limited sources of energy. I first met Josh when he agreed to walk 492 miles from Chicago up to the Republican National Convention in Minnesota. Upon return from that, he moved right into the local House of Hospitality and has been shifting all of his resources of energy and skill and compassion to making sure that people aren't going to be on the streets, at least in his, if there's anything he can do about it, in his own immediate area here in Chicago. And it's from these kinds of projects, the voluntary cores of people working with students in the inner city and people who are part of offering hospitality, that's been the group that we appeal to get Camp Hope launched and to kind of rub shoulders together while shivering together outside. And I know that those kinds of groupings exist all across the United States, mm-hmm. but sometimes we kind of have to catch courage from one another, I guess.
Kathy, let's talk a little bit about the work that you've started in Iraq during the sanctions, and then the, you know, trajectory that we have been following into this point. You went back there very early on during the sanctions, didn't you?
Yes, you know, I think that of any of the people I could imagine who would understand this, it would be you, Susan, because there was a certain point where you felt you just had to take an action, that you couldn't live with yourself if you didn't. And a number of us had been in Iraq in 1991, and we did our best as the Gulf Peace Team to try to give witness, a voice of opposition against the war. During the war, we were there and saw the aftermath and stayed in the region. I came back in August. But much to my own chagrin, in August of 1991, when I came back, I mean, Iraq had gone off of everybody's radar mm-hmm. screen, and so it started to go off of mine, too. But finally, by 1995, a number of people who knew more than many because of having been in Iraq during the 1991 war realized that war never ended. It had changed. Mm-hmm. And again, this is something I know you've seen firsthand. It had changed into an economic warfare that was far more punitive and brutal than even the worst of the bombardment, because children were directly being punished by a blockade, essentially a blockade. And so we began to go over to Iraq with delegations of people breaking the economic sanctions, carrying medical relief supplies. And as soon as we'd get back home, we really would literally hit the ground running. A lot of the people who went on the delegation said, you know, maybe taken a three-week vacation from their work, and they had to use the last 3 days of that vacation to call people in their faith-based communities at the universities and the media locally, assemble people and say, we've got to put an end to this. And it was this kind of passionate desire to educate people that I think formed much of the gridwork for the substantial resistance to the 2003 war. I mean, the world came closer than ever before to stopping a war before it started. Mm-hmm. And it didn't succeed. And that's a terrible tragedy, and it's directly related to each subsequent war. But it remains incumbent on us, as you've done through this radio show and your very brilliant writing, to keep telling the truth about the 2003 war and each war as it develops its hideous tentacles reaching into people's ordinary lives and causing bereavement and suffering and woe that will never end. So that's kind of what we've been about in the aftermath of the 2003 war, after having been there throughout that war and again into the first year of the occupation. We've tried very hard with Voices for Creative Nonviolence to, by virtue of the Occupation Project or a project aimed at going into the offices of people campaigning for election, now through Camp Hope, and we know in subsequent ways, to raise the level of education and raise the level of risk, nonviolent direct action, risking, you know, some inconvenience, some discomfort, maybe some freedoms, in order to oppose the war makers.
And here we are again. I mean, there's another escalation just going on right now in Gaza. We don't really see the pictures. Apparently, the Al Jazeera Arab channels are showing what's really going on there, and we're being protected from that in this country. But again, it's the children and the older people and the mothers and the civilians that are taking the brunt of this.
So, you know, if anyone thinks that our security is enhanced by attacking children, I think that must be subjected to reevaluation immediately. Probably one of the stories that's most stayed with me is that of a young boy hearing these explosions and running outside the door and seeing four of his school friends shot down in cold blood by the explosion. And he didn't talk from the time that happened until somebody from ISM reported about this, the International Solidarity Movement. He simply hasn't spoken a word.
That's a very important point. I mean, when I was in the West Bank in Israel in 2005, I talked with a psychologist who said this is a very common, up until recently, though, uncommon, but has become much more common symptom that they're seeing amongst children. Children can't concentrate. Some of them are not speaking because of the shock of seeing their homes demolished. So you're right. I mean, if anyone thinks that these things don't count in the long run, they're very, very wrong. They're definitely going to come back to haunt all of us.
Well, and I think that, you know, when people have shown images of the Warsaw Ghetto over the past 2 days, it's a fitting image. You know, people are traumatized and they're brutalized and they're trapped. And this young boy I spoke of hasn't spoken, but that doesn't mean that he doesn't have feelings of confusion and rage and outrage that's warranted, and bewilderment and wondering what can he ever do about his four slain friends, and who knows how many relatives or if he himself will survive. And so when we think about what happened as a result of the Warsaw Ghetto and the Holocaust, I think that, you know, we see that there was founded a state, a nation state, that said this will never happen again, no matter what measures we have to take. And that's the key to the spiraling violence. People say no matter what it takes, no matter what measures, we're going to defend ourselves. And so people who don't have anything close to remotely controlled drone surveillance aircraft or F-16s that the United States military might supply will then begin to take measures that they think might have some defense capacity for them. So this is something we have to look at. It's so seriously that, you know, anyone who tells us that this is going to improve our security, I think, is simply a dangerous and a reckless advocate for what jeopardizes our security.
Kathy, you're on your way to Egypt.
A number of people have been assembling at the Rafah border crossing, which is near, as near as you can go to Gaza. It's separated from Gaza by miles of electrified wire fencing, and 7,000 Israeli military are assembled there. But there's a great need, a desperate need for medicines, medical relief supplies, doctors, ambulances, trucks to immediately go into the area of Gaza for people who have been under blockade for such a long time already. And so there will be an effort to pressure the Egyptian government to open up that border. And some might be available then to go into Gaza if that's needed, or perhaps to see what kind of advice might come from projects like the Free Gaza Movement. But I'm very fortunate to be surrounded by people who were supportive in telling me it's okay to leave Camp Hope and go over to a site that's in proximity to Gaza and see if we can perhaps be useful. Bill Quigley, a lawyer whom I've grown to appreciate so much in his willingness to advocate on behalf of people in Haiti, people in Iraq. We first met him with Voices in the Wilderness and in places all over the world, but very especially in Katrina, in New Orleans in the aftermath of Katrina. And many of your listeners will have, I think, read Bill's writing on Common Dreams and other websites. He'll be joining, and also Barbara Lubin has headed over there from the Middle East Children's Alliance, and her long, long support for people in Gaza, and Audrey Stewart, who went with a number of us into the Jenin camp in 2002 while the Israeli military were telling us, you can't enter, give up, don't you? And we had a pillowcase tied to a broom pole, and in fact we're able to talk our way into that camp, and there we saw the tremendous destruction and havoc. Again, usage of conventional military forces against innocent people that occurred when the Israeli Defense Forces attacked the Jenin camp.
When you went into the Jenin camp, you saw the destructions you're talking about now, and we're expecting that the Gaza area is going to be a similar situation.
Well, I think it will be exponentially worse. I think in the siege of the Jenin camp, there were 100 three-story buildings that had been reduced to rubble, but many of the people were able to flee. This isn't to say that grandmothers and children weren't present. We ourselves had pulled a grandmother out from under the rubble and tried to get her to a hospital. But there was some capacity to flee. But people in Gaza have been trapped. This really is much more similar to the Warsaw Ghetto when the Nazis attacked people who had nowhere to flee, and they just mercilessly kept on raining down bombs and shooting in directions randomly. This is a kind of a collective punishment that I think is psychopathic in its cruelty and breaks every possible convention of the Geneva Accords and international law.
And Kathy, I can hear right now people saying, oh, well, how dare she compare this to the Warsaw Ghetto, because that was different. What do you say to those people?
Well, I think that one of the benefits of being able to read history is that we can understand the past from which we've come. And if we want to understand what the predictable results of attacking innocent people using conventional warfare with a disproportionate capacity to kill against innocent civilians, if we want to understand, okay, then what happens? Well, then you have generations of people who grow up with their perspectives somewhat skewed, as you could well imagine, who will say, no matter what it takes, mm-hmm. we have to be able to defend ourselves. And then in the foundation of the nation state of Israel, I think we've had people who have garnered the sympathies of the world saying, yes, people in Israel must defend themselves. But how have they defended themselves? They've undertaken the same kinds of tactics which were used against them.
And we actually have Mayor Bloomberg from New York in Israel right now saying that this is, you know, Israel is defending itself.
Well, I think we've had collaboration and complicity from capitals all around the world in their silence and their inability to continue to urge the United Nations to speak out. But the United Nations was founded to eliminate the scourge of warfare. We have a big responsibility to try to urge ongoing action on the part of the UN. Certainly the Reverend Miguel Descoto, who is now the president of the General Assembly, has done everything he can to speak vigorously and to organize action. And so let's be in support of those people who've got their heads screwed on straight, who can see that this kind of brute violence can only generate more of the same.
One of the things that's missing in my mind is something like a Truth and Reconciliation Committee. I'm not sure that we ever completely looked at what happened in the Second World War with the Holocaust, and that is bubbling up again, as you say. It's in our psyche, and we're beginning to pathologically act it out.
Well, and I think when situations reach a certain level of deterioration, it becomes much more difficult, it goes without saying, to try to introduce into the process some means of nonviolent direct action. I don't think it's too much of a stretch to ask Josh right now what his experiences are here in our own neighborhood when police brutality has been exercised against, for instance, kids on the street, you know, kids who are just walking home, and sometimes they're pulled over and picked up and subjected to rough and unfair treatment on the part of armed police people. And, you know, Josh believes in nonviolence, but after a while it's pretty hard to insert that into the picture. Josh, mm-hmm. I don't know, is that a fair analogy?
Well, I mean, I think so. I was just thinking of, you know, we were talking about a Truth and Reconciliation Commission there, and I was thinking of my friend Helen, who right now is studying in the human rights program in Sweden and is having a focus on Palestine, and just thinking about how much documentation there is being done of what's going on and human rights abuses and the commissions against torture. They issue these mandates, and those same mandates have been done, you know, here in Chicago. I'm with the Northside Action for Justice Cop Watch program, and we've done a lot of research into police brutality that's gone on here in Chicago, and it's already even been taken to a level that that several lawyers from the People's Law Office and in different places in Chicago have spoken in front of the UN, and there's been a mandate for the prosecution of people who've committed police torture and to hold accountable a police force that's done what it's wanted to for the past 30 years, and it still hasn't happened. So it's kind of a challenge to think, well, where do we move from here? How do we act, you know, lovingly, nonviolently, and support people who are being oppressed, you know, in a system that doesn't respond to the checks and balances that are there in place. So, yeah, it's quite a struggle.
Yeah. Well, this is what Obama has, in my mind, promised to do, isn't it? We're going to move forward in a different way, change we can believe in, and so forth. And again, this is why it's disappointing to hear this deafening silence from him on this issue.
Well, I think the disappointment is warranted. There tends to be historically in the United States a kind of wait-and-see attitude taken when an incumbent president reaches office, but that can often morph into inertia. So that's, again, why we're interested to foster this idea of Camp Hope, to make sure that the transition team working for President-elect Obama knows that there's no such thing as wait-and-see going on, that we can see right now that there's been an accommodation in this appalling silence that President-elect Barack Obama has shown in the face of the attacks against Gaza, that we don't at all want to morph into inertia. We want to be as active as we've ever been in saying that this is unacceptable and telling him that the funds are available, very available, to solve every single domestic problem that's been raised, and the funds are all sitting there under the control of the United States military.
I was just reading that the increase in the budget, in the defense budget, is like 7%, but it's like $35 billion for the 2009 budget. Well, divert that, you know. Does that have to go? For a start, let's divert that into something more useful.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I've been thinking of with Camp Hope, you know, is kind of a talking point is, you know, we can't expect, you know, everything to happen within the first, you know, few days of the administration. But at the same time, I mean, how quick did the government move to do these bailouts and to pull out the corporations out of the despair that they're in? But, you know, I think we can expect the same kind of quickness. I mean, when billions of dollars are being thrown around to banks for you know, their executives to take off on vacations, you know, I think that billions of dollars could be thrown around to build humanitarian security, and that I think that's going to do a lot more for all of these situations in Gaza and on the, you know, the domestic front in Iraq as well. We have a huge responsibility for the refugee crisis in Iraq, and I mean, I think that's one of the things that we have to be advocating for is that people's needs come first before all these other things. You know, if we build, you know, people can have the infrastructure to have a decent life, that should come before all else, and then, you know, we can think about other projects.
Of course, we do have this thing called the status quo, or pragmatic politics. This is a huge stumbling block, and we somehow have to name that in order to understand what it is and to be able to work on it. But right now, it's very implicit. It's not really, it hasn't really been surfaced enough that there are these interests in this country that will fight tooth and nail to prevent any kind of change.
Well, I think, you know, that is very intimidating. Boeing, Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, General Electric, the major insurance companies that don't want to see changes in terms of healthcare provision, the media companies that are owned by combinations of the military-industrial defense complex corporations, and then some of them by the drug companies. I mean, there's no sidestepping how huge this is. But I guess the correlation to that is that all of us can just probably go a few steps into our everyday life, and we're bumping into direct encounters with people who, in terms of corporate support for the status quo, could maybe be persuaded to say, hey, I don't feel so good about this anymore. I mean, I'm thinking of people who go to universities. Mm-hmm. And how many universities have ROTC right there on their campuses, or have science departments that are in direct cooperation with major defense expenditures, and they maybe are going along because they don't want to lose money? Or how many faith-based groups have within their congregations people who help pay for the congregation's expenses, but who might also be sitting on the board, CEOs of major corporations? I think a lot of people, when they go to work, you know, with jobs as, say, computer programmers or somewhere in the industry of communication, you know, might be actually tied in a little bit to some of the communications that have helped us now form the horrendous unarmed aerial vehicles, the drones that are launching laser-guided missiles because of their ability to surveil and be hunter-killer weapons. So we're all, you know, we're all part of one another. There's no doubt about that. But I think sometimes people feel ginger, and for reasons of politeness, they may not want to speak up because they're afraid they might hurt somebody's feelings or step on someone's toes or be speaking at an inopportune time when other people are trying to cope with very difficult problems, and we should certainly be sensitive to all of that, but not muzzle ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, Kathy Kelly and Josh Brulier, I'm really happy to have you with us. Let me just remind our listeners that this is Raising Sand Radio, and that we are going to stay in touch with Camp Hope. Well, Kathy, when will you be back from Egypt?
Well, I booked a ticket to come back on January 30th.
So maybe when you get back.
Short time, but if by any chance we're able to get into Gaza, it might be less certain about return trips. But there's also the boat possibility as well. So we're kind of keeping avenues open, but I really hope to be fulfilling some responsibilities that I'd already made myself available for in February.
Let's stay in touch when you get back. Let's do a follow-up. So hopefully there will no longer be bombing at that point, but there's going to be a tremendous amount of, collateral damage, I guess is what we call it these days.
Yeah, sometimes the news moves on, I think it'll be important to do everything we can to tell the United Nations that there is support for finally bringing the Israelis and the United States into some responsibility for committing war crimes.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, Susan, okay. I want to give you my very best. Thank you for all of your radio work and your writing work. I think your book is fantastic, and I'll share it with others here.
Thanks for having us on. And
thanks, Josh.
About our project.
Thanks a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye. We're going to go down to the location at Camp Hope in Chicago, and we're going to talk with Michael McPherson, Executive Director of Veterans for Peace. Hi, Michael.
Hello. How are you?
Oh, I'm good, and I expect it's pretty cold out there.
Yeah, I think it's like 16 degrees, and thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, it's great to have you, and I want you to tell our listeners what made you come down there and what you're seeing around you.
Okay, well, we're here at Camp Hope. I'm only going to be able to be here for a day, unfortunately. The reason I came is because with the election, and soon we'll have a new president, and I know that people all across the country, including myself, are hopeful that we'll be able to move our country in a more progressive and better direction. But I realize, as most of the people participating, and I say everybody participating in Camp Hope, realizes that in order for that change to take place, that we're going to have to make it happen, that the new president isn't just going to wave his hand, then all of a sudden things are going to be different. We're going to have to push him into the direction we want him to go, because we know that there are people pushing him in a different direction. So instead of trying to engage him in a negative way, we thought the best thing to do now is engage him in a hopeful, positive way and give him, I'm not going to say give him a chance, but help him understand this is the path that you need to follow. This is the direction that you need to go.
And have you seen any sign of him or any of his folks around?
I haven't, but I understand. I'm not sure what day, but a few days ago, either he or some of his representatives at least went by in a vehicle.
Mm. Yeah, we talked with Kathy Kelly earlier in the week, and she said that she'd seen him go by. So he at least knows that this is going on.
That's right. That's right.
And so, Michael, tell us a little bit about, you know, your background. You're the Executive Director of Veterans for Peace.
Well, as you just said, I'm the ED of Veterans for Peace. I'm a first Gulf War veteran, 1991. I have a son who's 24. He's out of the military, but he served in this particular, it's the same conflict, so I'd say this iteration of it, in 2005 to 2006. I've been Executive Director of Veterans for Peace since February 2005, and I'm also co-chair of United for Peace and Justice.
And our listeners can go to either of the websites. Veterans for Peace is?
Veterans for Peace, spelled out, veteransforpeace.org. Of course, unitedforpeace.org. You can go to that as well.
And learn more, yeah.
And I should also mention Iraq Veterans Against the War. Veterans for Peace helped that get going. So you can go to IVAW.org. That's a really good website.
That's an excellent website, yeah.
Yes.
So today and the next day or so, it looks as though Congress is going to vote on a resolution brought forth about the situation going on in Gaza. The 111th Congress, first session, starts off with recognizing the right of Israel to defend itself against attacks from Gaza and reaffirming the United States' strong support for Israel in its battle with Hamas and supporting the Israeli-Palestinian peace process in the Senate of the United States. Mr. Reed and Mr. McConnell submit the following resolution. Again, recognizing the right of Israel to defend itself against attack from Gaza and reaffirming the United States' strong support for Israel in its battle with Hamas and supporting the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. And on it goes. And it seems fairly, to my mind, one-sided. What do you think?
Well, obviously, it's extremely one-sided. And it's really a shame because if the United States was really, and I say the United States as not in the people of the United States, but the United States political leadership, was really interested in solving or at least helping move forward a peace process in that part of the world, then it would also have to hold Israel accountable for the things that it does. And you can't hold one side accountable. I don't necessarily agree with the violent reaction that Hamas has decided to take. But at the same time, I do understand that when you're frustrated and you see no hope, many times people lash out. I could go on and on, but I recently was talking to some people about this, and I think the bottom line is that Israel continues to take land from the Palestinians. That's the number one thing. They've never stopped. They're not dismantling settlements in a significant way. So there's no way that you can expect the Palestinians to believe in anything you say when you continue to do the thing which we're fighting over in the first place. Mm-hmm. And how can you hold Palestinians in terms of what the Palestinians do and don't do as individuals to the same level of accountability that you would hold Israel as a government? Mm-hmm. They have much more control over what they do than, you know, the Palestinian Authority, Fatah or Hamas do over their own people. So there's no way that you can equate the two. And I would just, last thing I would say, I'm not trying to defend the violent acts of Hamas, but I think that it's not put in the proper context, especially in that resolution that you just read. It's not put in the proper context whatsoever.
Right. I'm actually going to put a link on the radio website for this resolution so that listeners can go and download it and read the whole thing. But thanks for those words. And so, Michael, before we go, how many people are there today? What do you see around you?
Oh, well, today there's about 15 people. Other days we would have more. It depends.
Probably be more over the weekend, right?
I'm sorry?
Probably be more over the weekend.
I would think so. There's about 20 people coming up from St. Louis this weekend, so I'm not sure, you know, how many people will be here from the area, but at least 20 from St. Louis. It's cold, like I said, 16 degrees or so, snow on the ground.
Yikes.
Oh, 10 from Detroit also coming this weekend, I understand.
Oh, great. Okay.
Yeah, so this weekend should be, you know, a little more lively than it is right now.
Yeah. Well, someone's going to be holding down the camp the whole time, and it's great that you're there.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks go ahead.
I was just going to say, I don't know if any of your listeners, I know you're on the West Coast, right? So I don't know if anybody can make it out here before it's over. Or if you have some friends, tell them to come out if they live nearby.
Yeah, and this goes on until it's the 18th of January.
That's right.
Certainly, this show has already put the word out and will continue to do so. So if anyone does show up there from California, tell them to give us a call.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
All right.
Is Dan there?
Yeah, hold on. Let me find him. He took off. I appreciate your time.
No, it's great to have you, Michael. Thank you.
Okay, all right.
Hi, Dan. I can hear the siren going on in the background.
Yeah.
Michael described a little bit about what he saw around him today. Can you give listeners a sense of how they can get in touch with Camp Hope? And, you know, if they want to get there, is there a map on the website or all those sorts of things?
Well, there's a number of ways to get in touch with us. The best way would be to take a look at the website camphope2009.org. At that site, you can find an email to contact. There should be a phone number. You could also contact us through the website itself. that would be a good thing.
And David, you are David Pearson. You are coordinator with the project.
My name is Dan. Yeah, I'm a co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence.
Great.
Thanks, Susan.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks.
Kathy Kelly traveled to Egypt this week, and you can keep track of those travels at the Christian Radical website, which is http://thechristianradical.blogspot.com. And as Kathy Kelly mentioned, you can keep track of Camp Hope at www.camphope2009.org. Thanks for listening to Raising San Radio. And as usual, views expressed are those of the hosts and guests and not KZSU or Stanford University. Go to our website, www.raisingsandradio.org, to download archive shows. Or you can also email me at susan@raisingsandradio.org.